Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Huge numbers of Americans these days say the country's on the wrong track. It's hard to argue something's off kilter. Glenn Greenwald says look to the law and those who are not following it. In the halls of power, economic and government, Americans have come to tolerate a lawless elite, he says. And that, says Greenwald, is taking us down. This hour on Point, Glenn Greenwald on America's lawless elite. Joining me now from New York is Glenn Greenwald, columnist and blogger for Salon, former litigator and author of bestsellers How Would a Patriot Act and A Tragic Legacy. His new book out yesterday is With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Glenn Greenwald, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom.
I really want to unpack this, and in particular go back to your terrific discourse on the founders and how they looked at this. But look out across the landscape right now. Who are you talking about? Who's this lawless elite that has escaped American law?
You can look at the extraordinary number of crimes that have been committed over the last decade, egregious crimes by the nation's most powerful people, and see exactly who I'm talking about. So you look towards the worldwide torture regime that was established under the Bush administration, the spying on American citizens without the warrants required by the criminal law, the aggressive attack on Iraq, which is a crime that we declared would always be punished after World War II at the Nuremberg trials, various strains of obstruction of justice, such as destroying interrogation videos that were ordered by the courts and the 9/11 Commission to be preserved, lying to Congress, as the Department of Justice's own Inspector General found that Alberto Gonzalez did. And then you look to the private sector and see equally egregious criminality in the form of massive fraud that precipitated the financial crisis, the mortgage fraud scandal in which the banking industry has bombarded courts with knowingly fraudulent documents to take away people's homes, the involvement of the telecom industry in that illegal spying in violation of numerous laws written specifically for the telecoms. None of those is just a bad policy decision or an immoral act. They are crimes under clear law, and yet none of them have resulted in any meaningful criminal investigation, let alone prosecution or accountability, because we exempt political and financial elites from the rule of law in the United States.
We'll look at that. Does it slow down your critique, Glenn, that we see in the last couple of weeks Raj Rajaratnam, the big hedge fund trader, headed to prison for 11 years, that we see today? Criminal case brought against Rajat Gupta. I mean, he was on the board of Goldman Sachs. He was the head of McKinsey. You can't get much higher in American business than him. Does that cut your case?
No. I mean, first of all, I'm not talking about – these are not absolute. So you can periodically find, for example, ordinary Americans who receive leniency. But it's very rare, and it doesn't detract from the fact that generally ordinary Americans, people who are powerless, are subjected to the world's largest penal state and one of its most merciless. Conversely, you can periodically find elites, and I talk about them in the book, who are subjected to the rule of law. You saw some accountability, for example, with the Enron scandal, people who were very politically well-connected and wealthy. The governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, was indicted and convicted, mm-hmm. Louis Libby. And yet I think what you find in the cases where there are elites who are held accountable in those very rare cases, one of two things. Either their victims, the aggrieved parties, are themselves powerful elites. That's why Louis Libby, for example, was prosecuted, was because the primary complainant was the CIA, angry that he had exposed the identity of one of their agents. Or in a case where it's so brazen, so sleazy and egregious, that to protect the people who are doing it, such as in the insider trading cases that you just referenced, would really be to reveal the game. So yes, there are individual aberrations where you can be powerful and prosecuted if you really just engage in full-on theft of a massive scale out in the open. But the types of systematic abuse and illegal behavior, such as what precipitated the financial crisis, is what will continue to be protected.
You know, we're really going to dig into your case here, especially as I say the historical case, but bring it right up to date. But let me just put this to you first, Glenn. You know, you're well known as a strong, two-fisted progressive thinker, even crusader. What about to listeners who right off the bat are thinking, well, you know, this isn't about the law. This is just Glenn Greenwald doesn't like these people or their circumstances because they didn't follow his politics. It's a political debate here, not a legal issue.
Right. And that's why I think it's so important to emphasize that these are not policy disputes. If you look at how this immunity for elites is typically justified, the claim will be made that it's wrong to criminalize policy disputes. And yet none of the instances that I cited are examples of policy disputes. This was something that went back to the Iran-Contra scandal when that argument was made that it's wrong to prosecute Reagan officials because of a policy difference over whether to fund the Contras. And that was an extremely misleading bit of propaganda because there was a law in place, as clear as it could be, that criminalized the funding of the Contras in order to overthrow the Sandinista government. It wasn't a policy objection but a criminal offense that was at the heart of that scandal. It's the reason why Bush officials should be prosecuted for torture isn't because I think that's a bad policy. It's because we have criminal statutes in place that make it a felony to engage or to use or to authorize those interrogation techniques. The reason why the NSA scandal ought to have led to prosecutions isn't because I think it's bad or wrong to eavesdrop on Americans without warrants, even though I do. It's because there was a law in place for 30 years, FISA, that said it is a felony to eavesdrop on Americans without warrants, punishable by up to 5 years in prison or a $10,000 fine for each offense. Fraud, namely representing financial instruments as sound and valuable when you know they're actually toxic and worthless, is criminal fraud for which numerous people are in prison. So none of these have to do with political ideology. And the other thing I would add is that this is a purely bipartisan and ideologically transcendent dynamic. The elite of the United States, both Democrats and Republicans, liberal and conservative, have embraced these theories of elite immunity across the board. So you see the Obama administration leading the way in shielding the crimes of the Bush administration from accountability. So it has very little to do with partisan politics or ideology. And you see large numbers of people across the spectrum extremely angry over the impunity with which Wall Street tycoons have been able to commit crimes and ruin our economy with immunity as well. So I would suggest that in each of these cases, you can identify clear statutory prescriptions that have been violated that make them crimes.
And a big cultural shift, one that Glenn Greenwald says the founders predicted and warned against. He writes, America's political culture not only provides strategic advantages in the legal system to political and financial elites, but now actually grants them immunity when they knowingly break the law. Take us right back to the beginning, because you write, Glenn, that the founders did not set out to create an equal society. They knew and saw that people had different talents and different kinds of footings that would take them different places in life. But the thing that would make it equitable, if not equal, or was equality before the law. They were very, very strident on that. Take us back.
One of the principal grievances that the founder had against the king, and it's amazing because the founders had lots of different and very virulent disagreements amongst themselves about a lot of different topics, but on this they were in full unanimity, was that one of the abuses of the king was that he would exempt his minions and cronies and courtesans of the court and himself from the dictates of law. And he had the unilateral power, in essence, to wave his royal hand and make legal constraints and accountability disappear. And this is something the founders repeatedly complained about. And as a result, even though most of the founders, with the exception of a couple like Thomas Paine, but most of them were strong believers in not just the acceptability but the desirability of outcome inequality, by which I mean that some people would be rich and most would be poor, some would be powerful, most would be powerless, some would have great accomplishments, others would be ordinary. They believed in that kind of inequality, but it would only be legitimate, they all said, on one condition, and that is that we all abided by the same set of rules. That's what legitimizes inequality as an outcome. And that same set of rules is what the rule of law is, the fact that justice is blind, that we're all equal before the law, that we live under the rule of law and not the rule of men, all these cliches that we've been taught that come from this precept. And so it's not just a bad thing when we deviate from equality under the rule, under the law or these principles. This was supposed to be the anchor legitimizing everything else, that we played by the same set of rules and were treated the same when we violated them.
And we know they warned, it's right in our language. I mean, you remind us, you know, all equal before the law, justice is blind, no man above the law. These are just everyday, almost cliches that are deeply embedded in our cultural understanding.
Exactly. And this is why, you know, I think that it's interesting if you look at, for example, a lot of the commentary around the Occupy protest and the movements and the like. And there were a lot of questions being raised by mostly media stars and political elites along the lines of what is it that they're actually motivated by and why are they so angry and what is their agenda? And some have suggested that what they're angry about is the fact that there's large wealth and income inequality. And I think that's clearly not the case. We've had wealth and income inequality exploding for several decades. I think we're all taught that wealth and income inequality are to be expected, that it's even fair that people who achieve things and produce things earn more than those who don't. This is something, for right or for better or worse, embedded in the American culture. What is really motivating it is the sense that this has become illegitimate, that these gains are not deserved or meritorious, but ill-gotten, the byproduct of cheating, because there's a strain of people, a small strain, who are able to violate these rules with impunity, and they're not subject to the same set of laws and constraints as the rest of us. And it's the illegitimacy of the inequality, not just the inequality, that I think is spurning so much citizen anger and this loss of faith in the legitimacy of our political institutions.
Glenn Greenwald lays out a kind of a walk of shame here, from really adhering to the law to, he says today, really not. He goes back to Watergate. Here was September 8th, 1974, newly appointed President Gerald Ford addressed the nation to grant a full and free pardon to former President Nixon, saying that the reality of the situation called for it. Listen carefully to the language.
I deeply believe in equal justice for all Americans, whatever their station or former station. The law, whether human or divine, is no respecter of persons, but the law is a respecter of reality.
But the law is respecter of reality? What exactly and what reality are we in now? July 1987, then Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North testified in hearings of a joint congressional committee that was formed to investigate the Iran-Contra scandal. Questioned by Chief Counsel John Neils, North admitted that he had lied to Congress because he believed in supporting the Contras.
I will tell you right now, counsel, and all the members here gathered, that I misled the Congress.
At that meeting.
At that meeting.
Face to face.
Face to face.
You made false statements to them about your activities in support of the Contras.
I did.
Oliver North, I did. He was indicted on 16 felonies, later convicted of 3, ultimately vacated. Underlying charges dismissed. Barack Obama was very critical of a lot of things that went on in the early war on terror and wars around it. Last month, speaking at the retirement ceremony of Admiral Mike Mullen, President Obama said that the drone strike killing of American citizen cleric Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen was a success and major blow to al-Qaeda.
He repeatedly called on individuals in the United States and around the globe to kill innocent men, women, and children to advance a murderous agenda. The death of al-Awlaki marks another significant milestone in the broader effort to defeat al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
The law? Well, there's a long memo on that somewhere. Glenn Greenwald, what has happened here? How do we get on this slope? If we are on the slope that you say we are, what's the wedge that kind of got pushed in here? What's the change in presumption that we've come to operate on?
This is really the key point, because of course it's the case, as we talk about the founders and their belief in the rule of law and equality under the law, that they violated those principles in all sorts of extreme ways. Obviously, the nation was born of all kinds of obvious violations of that principle. The difference, though, is that even as we violated that principle, we continue to affirm the principle itself. And affirming the principle itself serves as an aspiration in terms of where we want to go as a society. And that's why we've seen such social progress over the last 2 centuries in terms of ridding ourselves of all of those extreme inequalities, or many of them, because we affirmed this principle that everyone was equal under the law. So even when we violated it, we knew where we wanted to go. What we began doing, and I trace it back to that Ford pardon of Nixon, and you heard it in the tape that you played, was we began repudiating the principle. So you notice that Gerald Ford says, the rule of law is something I consider extremely important. It's no respecter of person, which is the essence of the rule of law. But then he added a newly concocted amendment, which is the law is a respecter of reality, meaning that when we decide that there are bad consequences from applying the rule of law, we can go ahead and waive it. And since it's disruptive and divisive to hold political leaders like Richard Nixon accountable even when they get caught red-handed committing flagrant crimes. Because it's divisive and disruptive, we're going to shield them from accountability, the kind of accountability that we would impose on all other ordinary Americans. And this mentality that it is in the common good when political leaders are immunized rather than held accountable when they get caught committing crimes is what became the precedent, the rationale that was used to then immunize Iran-Contra criminals, the criminals of the Bush administration, and it's now been extended into the private sector as well. And so that's the difference between now and then. We've always violated the principle of the rule of law. We had never repudiated it explicitly before the way we do now.
Respect reality. Of course, reality can be just about anything. I mean, you take us all the way back to April 1784, Thomas Jefferson writes to George Washington. He says, "The foundation upon which any constitution must rest is," quoting Jefferson here, "the denial of every preeminence." But you're now talking about a lawless elite. That seems to be the definition of a preeminence.
Well, and what's most important about this is, and Jefferson goes on to say that the essence of America will be that the poorest laborer will be on equal footing with the wealthiest multimillionaire and even favored when, as he put it, their rights seem to jar. It isn't just that we've created this immunity for the elite class as I've described. I mean, if we were a society that wanted to be lenient with our criminals, you could have debates about whether that was a good or bad thing. But as long as we were applying leniency to everybody, at least then there would be equal application of that principle. What has happened over the past four decades when we've created this immunity for the elite class is we've done exactly the opposite for ordinary Americans. We've created an ever harsher and more punishing system of justice where we now imprison far more people in our country than any country in the world. We have 5% of the world's population roughly, and yet 25% of the world's prison population is in the United States. We punish people for longer prison terms, for more harshly, and for more trivial offenses than any Western nation.
You talk about a two-tier justice system there.
Precisely. So it's the very elite class that has vested itself with immunity when it commits crimes has imposed ever harsher punishments on ordinary Americans. And Richard Nixon is the perfect example. His career in the 1960s was revitalized, running as a law and order candidate, railing against the social disorder of the 60s and being too lenient on criminals and trying to understand their root causes instead of punishing them harshly as we should as a society. And yet that very same Richard Nixon, the minute that he got caught committing serious crimes, essentially appointed someone as his successor who he knew would immunize him. And this is really the illustrative two-tiered justice system personified, that this very same elite who brought us law and order himself was then immunized when he got caught committing much more serious transgressions than the people that he was harshly punishing.
It's not as though there hasn't been the sound of pushback and the sound of, you know, gnashing of teeth at this. I mean, even from Barack Obama himself, here's a little tape from, this is back in August 07, then Senator Obama talked about his strategy for fighting global terrorism. He then criticized the Bush administration for, as he said, undermining our Constitution and our freedom.
No more ignoring the law when it is inconvenient. That is not who we are. And it's not what is necessary to defeat the terrorists. The FISA court works. The separation of powers works. Our Constitution works. We will again set an example for the world that the law is not subject to the whims of stubborn rulers and that justice is not arbitrary.
But on rolled policy, even unto the Obama administration, maybe with their drone strikes, we'll look at that. But well before March 09, Senator Patrick Leahy, Vermont, headed a Senate Judiciary Committee on establishing a truth commission to investigate the Bush administration's wartime conduct. Here, Senator Leahy explains why.
How did we get to a point where Abu Ghraib happened? How did we get to a point where the United States government tried to make Guantanamo Bay a law-free zone in order to deny accountability for our actions? How did we get to a point where our premier intelligence agency, the CIA, destroyed nearly 100 videotapes, evidence of how detainees were being interrogated? How did we get to a point where the White House could say, if we tell you to do it, even if it breaks the law, it's all right because we're above the law.
It's all right because we're above the law. How did we get to that point? Glenn Greenwald's new book is With Liberty and Justice for Some. He joins us from New York. Glenn, we've got a lot of listeners lined up. Lita in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Lita, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a quick question for you. Obama just mentioned about the inconvenient truth. why is that not being addressed in our political system? That there has been a pyramid set up to where the elite are set at the top, the government is sitting in the middle, and the people are at the bottom. Why is it that the elite is allowed to control everything that goes on in this country? And when the people stand up, like Occupy Wall Street, the Senate and our elected officials can actually say that they are mobs and that they don't understand what their problem is and what their issues are. When you are speaking about all of the two-tier justices and the disruptive and inconvenient law and order that they are not abiding, what can we do about this? Why is this allowed to happen?
Glenn.
It's a fantastic question. I think it really gets to the heart of exactly what is happening in American political culture. Some people might listen to that question and think that sounds fairly radical and hostile. I would submit that it's become an increasingly common sentiment among ordinary Americans who understand exactly what's happening in the country. And what you see in Occupy Wall Street and the reactions to similar protests around the country is exactly what I'm talking about. You see the police force, the law enforcement arm of the government and the elites who control it, punishing those who are peacefully assembling, nonviolently assembling and exercising their constitutional rights, people who have committed no crimes and yet who are being pepper sprayed and abused and tear gassed and arrested by the dozens and now the hundreds, all in order to protect those who are the actual criminals, the people in the Wall Street buildings who have plundered our economic security and pillaged with complete impunity. And this is what I mean. The law isn't just about no longer preserving equality. It's now a weapon that the most powerful people use to shield their own criminality and their own ill-gotten gains from accountability. And you really see it personified perfectly in what's happening to these protest movements and how the government and the state and the people whom they're targeting are reacting.
Why this shift, though, Lita's asking? I mean, you're saying it was not ever thus. Some Americans might look back at history and, you know, the railroads and you name it, all the times in which big power has pushed hard and had its way and say, well, OK, it's always been like this. But you're saying no. If it's changed, why?
I mean, you can go back in history and you look at, for example, Teddy Roosevelt, who continuously stood up to the most powerful barons of the time and broke up monopolies and demanded prison terms and accountability for them and got them. Or Franklin Roosevelt, who proudly declared that he was wearing the hatred of Wall Street as a badge of honor. It's inconceivable to imagine our own political class doing that now. Part of it is because our elite class has found that it is in their interest to entrench this two-tier justice system because they benefit from it. They've created a whole litany of propagandistic precepts to justify it. The media and the journalist class that's supposed to be the watchdog over government and prevent these sort of abuses is now almost entirely – there are some exceptions – but almost entirely part of this power structure and advocates for this immunity as well. So I think that what you see is there's a split like there was when Ford pardoned Nixon, where political and media elites are in favor of this immunity and want greater law and order for ordinary Americans. But you see ordinary Americans becoming increasingly angry over this disparate treatment. So I think the answer to why is because people who are in power will abuse power if they can get away with it. And thus far, they've been able to get away with it. And that's why they do it.
Stuart in Maynard, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Stuart. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I don't believe I could make your guest's argument more lucidly or without losing my temper. It's very measured. But the nuanced addition I'd like to make is you can change the laws all you want. One of the problems is the nature of the judicial system. It's not truth-seeking. It's not even about justice. It's a collegiate adversarial system with rules, and money allows you to access more justice. A couple of examples. Abu Ghraib's a good one. The architects, the powerful within the military and civil, received promotions. The enlisted men who were applying the policy took pictures. It was undeniable and couldn't afford defense and went to jail. A more provocative criminal one would be the difference between Phil Spector and O.J. Phil Spector killed someone in his foyer. It wasn't deniable, and yet it took several years to prosecute him because he was rich and he could afford defense.
Stuart, let us pick it up right there, if we may. I mean, Glenn, you've worked for a decade or so as a litigator. You know the inequities that can be in our ordinary judicial system. You acknowledge those right up front in the book. But then you look at this higher tier, which you say is something else. What's the relative weight of this new, what you call a lawless elite, versus the sort of time immemorial inequity? You know, if you can afford a better lawyer, if you're, I don't know, better placed in society, you may have advantages in the court. But you're talking about something new here.
Right. I mean, the biases embedded in the judicial system that the caller is talking about are absolutely true, and they've gotten worse. And it is true that if you are wealthy, you can afford teams of lawyers that make it much more difficult for you to be convicted. Whereas if you're poor, you can't afford a lawyer, and the defense that you will be given by the state has become much worse with budget cuts. I think it's something like public defenders spend an average of 7 minutes with their clients who are charged with serious crimes. On top of that, you have judges who come mostly from elite ranks. They come from large corporate law firms and from prosecutors' offices or political circles, and they empathize with people in power. These are biases, socioeconomic biases that have been embedded for some time and have gotten worse. And I think a lot of people know about those. What I think is fundamentally different and worse, though, than that is that we're now at the point where if you are wealthy and powerful, you don't even get to court. You don't get indicted. You don't get prosecuted, with some exceptions. We have adopted the view, and I have so many examples in the book that I cite where media figures and prominent pundits and political figures argue this explicitly, that people in positions of prominence don't deserve to be put through the criminal process. It's not for criminal investigations and convictions and indictments, and courtrooms are not for people in positions of political power and financial wealth. We need them too much. They're too important to the society to put them through that. So they don't even need to take advantage of those advantages that they've long had. They don't even make it to the process at all because of this immunity that we've decided to vest in them.
What do you think the founders would say to that? Would they recognize it? Would they say, wait a minute, something's happened here? We don't know the country that's operating here? Or would they say, oh, we know exactly what's going on?
They would absolutely say they know exactly what's going on. Part of the reason they would know what's going on is because they witnessed it in terms of how the British Crown conducted itself. And it's part of what motivated them to wage an extraordinarily risky war against the then greatest empire on the planet in order to free themselves from. And they've said that repeatedly over and over. If you look at what Thomas Paine, the great revolutionary, said, he said, to those who ask, where is the king in America? Let a crown be placed on the head of law and have it be declared that law in America is king. That is what they repeatedly emphasized over and over.
A crown now. Occupy protests right here in Chicago this week. Glenn Greenwald says that may be in response to the change he's describing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former litigator, progressive, tough guy Glenn Greenwald about what he calls the rise of a lawless elite in America. He's put his argument and his evidence in a new book with Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's the sound of some maybe related opposition in the streets. Last night in Oakland, after repeated warnings to disperse, California Oakland police fired tear gas at least 5 times into a crowd of protesters. The Occupy movement there, local station KGO-TV captured the scene here. Another 53 protesters were arrested as part of Occupy Atlanta. WXIA-TV spoke with one protester who was determined to keep the 99% going any way he could.
Some of us will be occupying the Atlanta jail. Some of us will be occupying the Atlanta street. All of us will be occupying the park tomorrow.
Glenn Greenwald in New York, think about the Occupy movement. Think about the Tea Party movement. Do you see, I mean, we've got new numbers out today, new polls talking about sort of epic dissatisfaction with all kinds of things, with the, you know, the path we're on, with who favors what and who favors whom in this country. Are the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement scratching the same itch here, getting at the same concern?
I absolutely think so. There certainly are some differences. We've been divided as a citizenry among by a whole slew of familiar conflicts that keep people who have similar interests separated from one another and angry with each other and warring with one another and at each other's throats and not focused on those who are wielding true power. So there's certainly differences along those lines. But a significant motivating force behind the Tea Party originally was the bailout of Wall Street. And the argument there was that there was this vast economic elite that was saved and propped up and eventually enabled to profit greatly, even more than they were before, by the same government that did very little in the face of extreme economic suffering on the part of the lower middle class and the working class and even the middle class. And so it was very much grounded and still is grounded, the Tea Party movement is, in the idea that the government does not work for the ordinary American but instead for large corporate donors and for Wall Street and for the banks. Obviously, that is a very significant part of the Occupy movement as well, hence the Occupy Wall Street name. These are citizens who, although expressing themselves in somewhat different ways and identifying themselves in a different place on the ideological spectrum, nonetheless are voicing the same grievance, which is that the system of government that they have long believed in and that is supposed to be the guarantor of equal opportunity is radically broken. It's been co-opted by a small elite that use it to protect themselves and their interests at the expense of everybody else's.
There may be the overlap. Tease apart the distinctions for us then.
Well, one of the distinctions is the role that government is supposed to play. I mean, the Tea Party movement is not very different than essentially a rebranded right wing that has long been part of the Republican Party that believes that government has very little role to play in regulating or imposing constraints. Whereas the Occupy movement, I think, is much more in favor of the government doing so. But I think
– rebranded left wing in its way?
I don't think so, and I think you can even overstate the case to which the Tea Party is a rebranded right wing, and I say that for this reason. The criticism of Occupy Wall Street for a long time, from the beginning, and you even hear it now, was that it was too inchoate. There weren't specific policy proposals it was demanding. It wasn't about specific pieces of legislation that it wanted. It wasn't focused enough on the kinds of acts that it wanted the government to take. That was very much true of the Tea Party for a long time as well. If you look at the beginning of the Tea Party movement, it was very difficult to know who they were and what they wanted and what they were protesting about. And I think that more than a right-wing ideology or a left-wing ideology, what both movements are about is an extreme anger and dissatisfaction with our political institutions, not one of the other parties, but the political culture generally. And polls show this. And the reason why they're not demanding specific pieces of legislation is because they don't have faith in the political process. It's about expressing dissent from the political culture generally, from stepping outside of the voting booth and from loyalty to one of the two parties and saying those no longer provide an adequate vehicle for effecting change. We need to go out into the streets in order to do it. And that's why I think it's much less about we're the right wing and we love Republicans or we're the left wing and we want to rebrand ourselves and much more about we are citizens who feel we are getting shafted by the very institutions that were supposed to ensure that we at least had equal opportunity.
Tea Party people went in considerable numbers in the midterms into those polls, put a very significant freshman class in the House of Representatives with very material consequences in terms of U.S. policy.
You're right. They did, and they translated that into the voting booth. Although what I think is important to note is that they did it not as part of the Republican Party. They weren't foot soldiers for the Republican Party. They did it as much in opposition to the Republican Party as in support of it. So a lot of those candidates, in fact, many of the most significant ones, were not people endorsed by the Republican establishment, but were people opposed by it. They removed Republican incumbents who had been in office for a long time. In many cases, they defied the Republican establishment and nominated people who had much less of a chance to win than the establishment candidate and who in many cases did lose winnable races for the Republican Party. So you're right, they went into the voting booths, but they didn't do it as loyal foot soldiers of the Republican Party. They did it to radically change a political party that they believed was as captive to the elites as they perceived the Democrats as being.
Annie in Hingham, Massachusetts. Annie, you're on the air with Glenn Greenwald.
Hi, Glenn. I'm so excited to read your book, and I thank you so much for giving voice to things that most of us just intuitively felt but weren't able to verbalize. And it just feels so good to have somebody be able to have a cogent way of saying what we kind of all intuitively felt. My question to you is that Senator Obama, I could have imagined having sat where you're sitting right now with Tom talking about it when he was a senator. He's a brilliant man, a legal scholar. And my question to you is, what happens? Like, what is the process? I understand, you know, power corrupts, et cetera. But when you have someone as smart and idealistic and didn't go to Milton, didn't come up, he's not, you know, Obama legal family. I mean, he knows what it's like to be the underdog, et cetera. I'm very curious how quickly he lost it. I'm really interested in any role that Geithner may have played. And also, Tom, when you had that guy on who was talking about how there's only 100 people in the government who are prosecuting the financial...
This was William Black from University of Missouri saying prosecute the Wall Street crimes. Yeah.
But there were 1,000 prosecutors on the savings and loan. So,
yes.
I'm just curious on a personal level. It's very interesting to me. Like, what happened?
Glenn, can you whittle that out for us?
It's a great question. I mean, it's difficult to assess anyone's motives, including our own. We can assess people's actions. But I think there are some important pieces of evidence to consider, because you're right. When he was a senator and then a candidate, he not only opposed virtually every one of the Bush-Cheney controversial terrorism policies that he has now embraced as his own, but he was adamant that the rule of law was being trampled upon and needed to be reinstated. So he opposed the appointment of General Hayden, for example, a CIA chief, because he had overseen what Obama called the illegal eavesdropping program. And he had that clip that Tom played earlier, that the rule of law must be adhered to, no more ignoring the law when it's inconvenient. I think, you know, part of the problem is that from the start, President Obama is actually much more of an establishmentarian than he is any sort of challenger to establishment power. And that's why he immediately surrounded himself with the very same people responsible for the policies that he ran against. His economic team was filled with Reubenites who were responsible for the deregulation orgy of Wall Street. His national security team was filled with Iraq war supporters, such as his vice president and his secretary of state. And so, you know, you can ask the question, it's a chicken and egg question. Was he influenced by those people to continue the very things he said he wouldn't do? Or did he choose those people because that was his inclination anyway? I mean, part of the motive is clearly political. If you continue the Bush-Cheney policies of terrorism and lawlessness, and then there's a terrorist attack, you aren't vulnerable to being accused of being responsible by having gotten rid of those policies. It's a political calculation. But I think a big part of it is that when leaders believe in their own magnanimity, when you constantly believe your own PR, I'm a progressive, enlightened, political, constitutional scholar, I think you believe that accountability and checks and legal constraints are only when bad people are in office, those bad Republicans. But when I'm a good person and I'm a good, well-intentioned leader, I don't need accountability. I can fight wars like I did in Libya without congressional authority because I'm not going to be corrupted. Or I can spy on Americans and keep my legal reasoning for why I'm targeting American citizens for death a secret because I should be trusted. And that is a corrupting aspect of power, the self-flattering image that one is too pure, too elevated, too enlightened to really succumb to the temptations of power. And what political scientists and people who study human nature and the founders all pointed out is that power inevitably corrupts when it's exercised in the dark and without checks and accountability.
Well, let's get off our high horse for just a second here. I've heard people imagine the briefing Barack Obama had on Inauguration Day, let's say the security briefing, and they come in, they bring in, they describe the threats, and they're multifarious, they're all over the place, they're urgent, they're huge. He feels that responsibility for taking care of, you know, the American people. And the next thing you know, you've got Anwar al-Awlaki. He's an American citizen, but he's seen to be inciting terrorist attacks in this country. It looks very difficult to get him into any kind of judiciary process. I mean, can't you see how the sort of get real view of the world would become very hard to resist there? And should he in any and all circumstances resist it?
Well, first of all, this was the argument that supporters of George Bush repeatedly made to those of us who are critiquing their abuses of power. So anyone who now makes that argument in defense of Barack Obama, namely that, well, I thought these policies were wrong, but it turns out that he believes and he learns all these secret things about threats that justify these policies, probably owes George Bush and Dick Cheney an apology, since you're essentially saying that the things they were saying about why they did what they did is something that with the Democrat in office you now believe in. Secondly, if you look at the oath of office that the president takes, it is not I will do anything possible to safeguard the national security of the United States. It is I will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And Obama himself frequently said that we not only are able but better able to defend the country when our leaders are constrained by the rule of law, because when you're not constrained by the rule of law, that is when you start doing abusive things that actually make things a lot worse. And so, you know, there are different values that need to be weighed. And I think that we should look at what Senator Obama and Candidate Obama said on these very questions, which is that we cannot accept a leadership that in the name of national security insists it can act without constraints, because we have more important values as a nation that we need to protect and preserve in order to make our security worthwhile.
Barack Obama, August 07, 2007, no more ignoring the law when it is inconvenient. That is not who we are. The law is not subject to the whims of stubborn rulers. Bill in Barrie, Vermont. Bill, you're on the air with Glenn Greenwald. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I just have a few comments. I know time is short. My comment is this. I've studied a lot of history. If you go back 1,000 years to the Middle Ages, you'll see that what we are living in today is, I believe, neo-feudalism. We have a corporate state that is controlling everything, and I believe the government is the king, and the corporations are the lords and lieges, and they go about their business and with very little regard for the actual laws that we have in place in this country. And I believe that needs to be changed. And Glenn, thank you for what you're doing, and keep doing it. And I'd like to hear your comments off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. Glenn, have we gone from neoconservatism to neo-feudalism?
Well, what's really interesting is that language like that, when applied to the United States, even a decade ago, used to cause most people to kind of act, you know, to recoil. And this is not – these kind of terms are not appropriate for the United States. And what you've seen over the past decade or past several years is that this kind of description of the United States has really made its way into the mainstream. That's how severe this crisis has become. So you see, for example, Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, the columnist, talking about America as being a third world banana republic because of these vast inequalities. One of the best articles written over the last several years was by Simon Johnson, the former chief economist for the IMF. You can't get more mainstream than that. It was called The Quiet Coup, and it talked about how the nation is now run by an oligarchy, and that the reaction to the financial crisis was what he saw in corrupt developing countries like Argentina and Russia, where the oligarchs use their control over government to make sure that the crisis that they create is first responded to by protecting their interests at the expense of everybody else's. So you see this kind of language, neo-feudalism, coups, banana republic, third worldism, being increasingly applied to the United States, not by radicals and dissidents, but by the most mainstream sources, because I think that the evidence empirically compels those assessments to be made.
Glenn, let me get one more call. James in Greenwood, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you? I forget the guy's name that you're talking
Glenn.
To right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but they have a whip. I'd like to get in touch with him if I can. But I guess what I wanted to say was it's going to be very difficult to do. The young lady 2 calls ago was asking why have Obama changed. And the biggest reason he's changed is the biggest problem that we're having in politics is finance, the way these political parties are financed. And Obama, if he's going to get any money, he has to start doing things. When he got in, before he was there, you know, he represented us. But when he got there, he realized he's going to need money in order to re-represent us. So and all of that money basically comes from Wall Street contributors.
James, we've got it. Do you have a question for Glenn Greenwald there, James?
Yes. What I wanted to ask was, where do we go from here? So that's what I was asking for the website.
We've got it. Our time is short. Where do we go from here? Thank you, James. Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the promise of the Obama campaign, the reason why people got excited by it, even though in 2008 it was funded by Wall Street as well, his campaign was because it was really supposed to be the vehicle where citizens could affect change, circumventing the corporate power structures that control Washington. And I think most people who believe that now see that that didn't happen and are disillusioned. Where do we go from here? You look to the changes that took place in the Middle East against much greater odds, where people went into the street and expressed their anger and demanded change. I think that's the kind of citizen reaction that's going to be necessary in order to effectuate this kind of change, to really make the elites realize that they cannot continue on this course any longer. And that's the reason why I even liked the Tea Party reaction, even though I disagreed with many of their premises. And I'm particularly inspired by the Occupy movement, because I think that's what's going to be necessary to start to really unhinge these premises and force change rather than requesting it or trying to vote our way to it.
Tahrir Square, not the voting booth. I mean, the voting booth is right there in the Constitution's founders' view, too.
Absolutely. But when the system becomes so corrupted that the only choices you have are essentially similar, sometimes citizen protests, like the founders concluded when they waged a revolution, it becomes necessary.
Big conclusion on a big book. Glenn Greenwald's new book is With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Glenn Greenwald, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.